The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine, dated June 7th, 2013. And now, as usual, we'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first article is entitled, Redefining the War on Terrorism. President Obama called for an end to what he called America's perpetual war against terrorism last week, announcing plans to set limits on the use of drones and begin moving out some of the detainees at the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In the first major foreign policy speech of his second term, Obama said he would work with Congress to refine and ultimately repeal the post-9/11 legal framework, giving the president a virtual blank check to use force against terrorists. Citing James Madison's warning that no nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare, he said the time had come to redefine the U.S. war against a decimated Al-Qaeda. Our systematic effort to dismantle terrorist organizations must continue, Obama said, but this war, like all wars, must end. Obama expressed ambivalence about his use of unmanned drones to kill terrorists abroad, acknowledging that such strikes have killed civilians and radicalized local populations. Those deaths will haunt us as long as we live, he said. But he said he would continue to use drones against terrorists, targeting only those who pose a continuing imminent threat to Americans, with the near certainty that no civilians would be killed. Obama called on Congress to help him close Guantanamo Bay and said he was lifting his ban on transferring some of the prisoners to Yemen and other Middle Eastern countries. Now here's what the editorials had to say. It's about time, said the Baltimore Sun. Obama injected some reason and morality into the fight against terrorism this past week after more than a decade of chest thumping by our elected leaders. While the drone policy has been undeniably effective, its lack of transparency or accountability has damaged our credibility overseas. Guantanamo, too, has become an emblem of overreaction and abuse, said the Los Angeles Times. Obama made a strong statement about our core values of freedom and the rule of law this week. Even better would be comparably strong action. All Americans long for an end to the war on terror, said the Chicago Tribune, but we're not there yet. Obama's drone campaign has been extremely and surgically effective in killing Al-Qaeda leaders in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Yemen. Now is not the time to strangle it in slow-motion bureaucracy by adding layers of oversight or allowing judges in Washington to second-guess military leaders. The killing of Americans in Benghazi and Boston proved the U.S. needs to keep those drones flying. And now here's what the columnist said. This was a speech for grown-ups, said James Fallows in the Atlantic.com. For the first time since 9/11, a sitting president has had the courage to challenge the insidious notion that in the post-9/11 era, the terrorist threat eclipsed all others America had faced and justified the abrogation of liberties and principles we had defended through the centuries. Watch what Obama does, not what he says, says Glenn Greenwald in Guardian.com.uk. He issued no timetable for repealing post-9/11 laws, giving the commander-in-chief virtually unchecked military authority, nor any detail about how his drone program would be overseen. This speech was intended to convince progressives that Obama is a deeply thoughtful, moral, complex leader, even as he pursues the Bush-Cheney path of unchecked executive power. Obama can't have it both ways, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. He wants to be seen as both the sane, moderate alternative to George W. Bush and also the tough guy president who killed Osama bin Laden and rained hellfire on al-Qaeda's leadership. As usual, Obama is trying to sound thoughtful while arguing both sides of every argument. Obama's ambivalence isn't just an act, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. If Bush was the decider, Obama is the agonizer. He wrestles with the moral complexities of war like the lawyer he is, attempting to balance the risk of civilian casualties against the cost of inaction and the merits of drone strikes against abuse of power they invite. When contrasted with the smug certainty of his predecessor, this is a good thing, but only if all that analysis leads to specific policies. Without action to match Obama's rhetoric, the war on terrorism will continue much as before. The next item from the main story section is entitled Hezbollah Joins Syria's War. Fears that Syria's civil war would escalate into a full-blown regional conflict grew last week after the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah vowed a total mobilization to fight alongside the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. This battle is ours, and I promise you victory, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah said in a televised address. Before he spoke, 23 people were killed in the Lebanese city of Tripoli as Alawites loyal to Assad battled Sunnis. In Syria, rebel chief General Salam Idris said his forces fighting for control of the strategic Syrian town of Quasar would pursue Hezbollah to hell. The escalation prompted the European Union to lift its embargo on arming Syrian rebels, while Russia said it would deliver S-300 anti-aircraft missiles to the Assad regime. The EU agreed to delay the delivery of any weapons until upcoming peace talks in Geneva, which the Assad regime tentatively agreed to attend. But rebel groups said they wouldn't talk until a deadline was set for Assad's departure. Hezbollah's announcement is a terrifying development, said Dexter Filkins in NewYorker.com. What has until now been a war of attrition between Syria's Sunni Muslim majority and the leading Shiite Alawite minority is now growing into an all-out intra-Muslim war as pro-Shiite Iran and pro-Sunni Saudi Arabia battle for influence over the region. Brace yourself for the consequences. The need for American intervention is more urgent than ever, says Ray Takei in New York Times. And we need to go big, a full air assault to destroy Assad's air force and boots on the ground to mediate sectarian conflicts and set up a transitional government. Half measures like no-fly zones won't end Syria's war, which has already claimed 80,000 lives. Indeed, a half-hearted U.S. intervention would only embolden Iran's hardened rulers, who are currently engaged in a fundamental struggle for the future of the Middle East. Intervening won't solve one huge problem, said Caroline Glick in RealClearWorld.com. Standing opposed to Assad and his Hezbollah and Iranian protectors is al-Qaeda. So we either leave in power one of the most dangerous leaders in the world, or who also happens to be a vassal of Iran and a mass murderer, or we help a rebel force whose most effective military faction is the Nusra Front, a branch of al-Qaeda. There are no good guys. The next item is entitled Renewed Violence in Iraq. A wave of deadly bombings threatened to unleash a new sectarian civil war in Iraq this past week as the country's Shiite-led government cracked down on a growing Sunni rebellion. Tit-for-tat attacks have targeted Sunni mosques and Shiite neighborhoods, pushing the death toll to nearly 1,000 people over the past 2 months. Sunnis have accused Shiite Prime Minister Nuri al-Maliki of targeting their community with arrests and spurious terrorism charges. Al-Maliki, I should have said. I mispronounced that. I'm sorry. Al-Maliki last week ordered the Iraqi army to suppress the Sunni militant groups operating near the border with neighboring Syria, amid concerns that the increasingly sectarian civil war there could spill into Iraq. Since U.S. troops left, tensions in Iraq have been overheating, said Ramzi Mardini in foreignpolicy.com. Now the fighting in Syria has become an accelerant, speeding the country toward all-out war. Al-Maliki rightly fears that if Sunni rebels in Syria oust President Bashar al-Assad, they could partner with Sunnis in Iraq to create a transnational sectarian cause aimed at removing Shiites from power, including in Baghdad. Iraq isn't on the brink yet, said Shashank Joshi in CNN.com. The Iraqi state is much stronger than in the darkest days of the insurgency, and many Sunni groups appear eager to keep the violence in check. So, too, are Iraq's political elite, said Dan Murphy in CSMonitor.com. Both Shiite and Sunni political leaders have profited handsomely from high oil prices in recent years, and they want to protect those gains. The real driver of Iraq's violence is Baghdad's over-centralization of power, said Michael Knights in foreignpolicy.com. Al-Maliki and his inner circle have essentially rebuilt a version of the authoritarian system they sought for decades to overthrow. Unless they relax their iron grip on the military, the economy, and the judiciary, and agree to share power with the provinces, the country will splinter violently. Loosening the ties that bind Iraq together is a risk, but holding too tightly is a much greater danger. The next item from the Week magazine, the main story section, is the controversy of the week. And this week it's entitled, Obamacare, Does California Prove It Can Work? There's an Obamacare shock coming, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. But the people who'll be shocked are the conservatives, who've been gleefully predicting that the president's health care reform will be a disaster. The big question hanging over the law has been how much the uninsured will pay for coverage through state-run exchanges when the mandate kicks in next year. Last week, California, the law's most important test case, revealed that the premiums insurers will charge customers through its exchange are surprisingly low due to strong competition. A single person would pay only $276 a month for a silver plan with moderate coverage, or just $104 if his income qualifies him for government subsidies. A bronze plan with the barest level of coverage would cost a young person just $172 a month before any subsidies. Of course, not every state is going to have as happy an experience, said Matthew Iglesias in Slate.com. Out of sheer spite, Republican-run states such as Texas, Florida, and Alabama are refusing to help implement the law, guaranteeing higher premiums and more chaos. But as the inevitable problems in Obamacare get ironed out over time, Americans will know that if they lose their jobs or their employers don't provide health insurance, they'll be able to buy coverage at affordable prices. In concrete terms, this has all the hallmarks of a successful and popular initiative. Don't bet on it, said Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com. California's health insurance prices may seem low, but even without Obamacare, young, healthy people can buy bare-bones plans right now for under $200 a month. They can also choose to go without insurance at all, an option they lose under Obamacare. If young people refuse to comply with the mandate and decide to pay the $95 per person penalty instead, it will bring about the Obamacare nightmare scenario, said Peter Suderman in Reason.com. Then most of the people signing up for coverage will be older and sicker, causing premiums to skyrocket and reinforcing public skepticism of the law as an unworkable burden. That's certainly the Republicans' hope, said Ezra Klein in the Washington Post. They are so dedicated to Obamacare's failure that they are blocking the tweaks any big law requires and are actively trying to make it as big a mess as possible, on the assumption that voters will blame Democrats. But if blue states like California, Oregon, and Washington are running working near-universal health care systems by the end of next year, it will throw problems in Republican-run states into stark relief. Voters may well direct their anger not at Obamacare, but at the Republican governors and legislators who have failed to implement a clearly workable law. The reality is that no one still really has any idea whether Obamacare will work or not, said Robert Samuelson, also in the Post. The law's plumbing is still under construction, with a majority of states yet to unveil their own exchanges, and the federal government still deciding how it will run exchanges in 27 states where lawmakers have refused to set them up. Much uncertainty also remains for the people most affected by the law, the uninsured, small business owners, part-time workers, and the self-employed. Will small companies fire workers or cut salaries to pay for insurance? Will millions of people choose to pay the fines rather than comply with the mandate? As 2014 draws near, all that remains shrouded in the fog of Obamacare. Now we'll turn to the popular column, Good Week For and Bad Week For. Always a little bit brighter note than the opening stories there, right? The first item here is, it was a good week for cheating with news that a ladder might be installed near the peak of Mount Everest. Authorities in Nepal say the ladder would provide a shortcut over a steep cliff. And thus ease congestion near the 29,035-foot high summit of the world's tallest mountain. It was a good week for skiing in shorts after parts of the Northeast received up to 18 inches of snow over Memorial Day weekend. Snow blanketed parts of Vermont, New Hampshire, and upstate New York. And it was a good week for synchronicity. After twin sisters Erica and Tashina Ackley, 22, who found out they were pregnant on the same day, gave birth just hours apart in the same main hospital. We thought it would be cool if we had our babies on the same day, said Tashina, but we didn't expect that that would happen. And it was a bad week for North Dakota, which U.S. Census Bureau data revealed to be the state with the most bars per capita, with one bar for every 1,600 residents of the sparsely populated state. It's not surprising at all, said bar owner Jason Stein. There's not much else to do here. It was a bad week for getting to the point after a Norwegian crime writer set a new record for the world's longest interview. Hans Olaf Lahlum spoke for over 30 hours straight to journalist Mads Andersen on topics including U.S. politics, chess tactics, and kebab recipes. 30 hours, he spoke. And it was a bad week for ageism after Japanese climber Yuichiro Mori, 80, became the oldest man ever to reach the top of Mount Everest. Mura recommended that other seniors eat good food and just get out of the house. He reached the summit without a ladder. Now from the Week magazine, we will turn to the briefing section. Our article this week is entitled, The Biometrics Boom. New technology can identify you by unique traits in your eyes, your voice, and your gait. Is there cause for alarm? Well, what is biometrics? It is the science of identifying individuals by their unique biological characteristics. The best known and earliest example is fingerprints used by ancient Babylonians as a signature and by police since the turn of the 20th century to identify criminals. But in the last decade, there's been a boom in more advanced biometric technology, allowing people to be identified and sometimes remotely tracked by their voices, the irises of their eyes, the geometry of their faces, and the way they walk. The FBI is currently consolidating existing fingerprint records, mugshots, and other biometric data on more than 100 million Americans into a single $1.2 billion database. When it is completed in 2014, police across the country will theoretically be able to instantly check a suspect against that vast and growing array of data. Law enforcement officials are enthusiastic about this growing power, while civil libertarians are aghast. A society in which everyone's actions are tracked is not, in principle, free, said William Abernathy and Ted Lay-Tien of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. It may be a livable society, but would not be our society. How did the boom come about? The age of terrorism has created enormous interest in and lowered resistance to identifying and tracking individuals in a very precise way. Biometrics represent what terrorists fear most, an increased likelihood of getting caught, said Homeland Security spokesman Russ Nock. Since 2002, the government has fingerprinted all foreign visitors to the U.S. at airports and borders, collecting approximately 300,000 prints per day. In Afghanistan and Iraq, U.S. forces have gathered iris data from 5.5 million people to identify suspected insurgents and prevent infiltration of military bases. Fueled by the growth of its iris scans in particular, the global biometrics industry now has revenues of $10 billion and is expected to double that in 5 years. Well, how do the iris scans work? Every person has unique patterns within the colored part of his or her eye. A device scans your iris and compares it with photos of irises on record, identifying people with accuracy rates of 90% to 99%, depending on the conditions and system used. Iris scanners are now widely used on military bases and federal agencies and at border crossings and airports. An improved version can remotely assess up to 50 people per minute, making it possible to scan crowds for known criminals or terrorists whose iris patterns are on file. Facial recognition technology, which identifies people through such geometric relationships as the distance between their eyes, has also come a long way. The technology is still only about 92% accurate, but the error rate halves every 2 years, said facial recognition expert Jonathan Phillips. What other biometrics are there? The U.S. military is already using radar that can detect the unique rhythm of a person's heartbeat from a distance and even through walls. That technology is being developed for use in urban battlefields, but may one day become a law enforcement tool. A person's gait, too, is completely individual, and the technology to recognize it has advanced to the point where a person can be identified by hacking into the sensor that tracks the movement of the cell phone in his or her pocket. Because it does not require any special devices, the gait biometrics of a subject can even be captured without him or her knowing, said Carnegie Mellon University biometrician Marios Savides. What are the privacy implications? Civil rights groups warn that if these technologies are not restrained by law, they could be used in truly Orwellian ways. No laws currently limit data collection from biometric technology or the sharing of that data among federal agencies. Law enforcement officials can use driver's license photos to identify or hunt for suspects. For example, the government or private companies could collect a person's biometric data without his consent and use it to track his movements. That has enormous implications, not just for security, but also for American society, said Chris Calabrese of the American Civil Liberties Union. Is there any turning back? Probably not, especially now that private companies are embracing biometrics. Already, TD Bank and Barclays Bank are using voice recognition technology to verify account holders. In the not-too-distant future, we'll be able to start our cars with our fingerprints, use facial recognition or iris scans instead of passwords on smartphones and other electronic devices, and have doctors check our medical records by scanning our faces. These uses of biometrics will provide convenience and efficiency, but at a steep price in privacy. Iris technology that reads our eye movements, for example, will be able to determine what we look at in stores, then use that data to create highly personalized advertising aimed at what we've displayed interest in. For companies and governments, said the ACLU's Jay Stanley, the incentives associated with biometrics all point the other way from privacy. And now the footnote to this briefing on the biometrics boom is entitled The Biometrics in the Third World. Here in the U.S., proposals to put biometric data on Social Security cards have faltered because of concern among civil libertarians and conservatives over government overreach. But in much of the developing world, the concept of personal privacy carries less legal and cultural weight, and there a biometric revolution is taking place, with some 160 massive data-gathering projects underway. Until recently, more than a third of people in developing countries were not registered in any way at birth, making it hard for them to open bank accounts, get government benefits, or vote. Biometric IDs could change that. India is taking the fingerprints and iris scans of all 1.2 billion of its citizens. Nandan Nikalani, the founder of outsourcing firm Infosys, and the project's leader, says being identified will allow India's largely anonymous masses to claim services to which they're entitled under the law rather than being forced to bribe bureaucrats. Unique identification is a means to empowerment, he said. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining us today. Now we're going to turn to the best column section in the Week magazine. Our first column is entitled, How We Abandon Our Veterans. It was written by Sebastian Younger in the Washington Post. In America today, only soldiers bear the moral burden of war, said Sebastian Younger. All Americans should share the responsibility for the carnage in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past 12 years, because we collectively approved these wars and sent young men and women to fight them. But the all-volunteer army has opened a yawning cultural gap between the military and 99% of our population. When veterans come home, people slap them on the back, call them heroes, and ignore the damage that so much death and horror has done to their souls. In tribal societies, returning warriors undergo rituals to spiritually cleanse them of the obscenity of war, and are asked to tell their stories to the community in great bloody detail. This process enables the warriors to share their terrible burden and reminds everyone that the war was fought in their behalf. Deprived of any such catharsis, more than 500,000 of our veterans are struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, alcoholism, and other dysfunctions. They need us to listen to them, not throw them parades. The next column is entitled, Where Even Fools Have Job Security, and it was written by Daniel Foster in NationalReview.com. How do you solve a problem like Lois Lerner, asked Daniel Foster, Lerner, director of the IRS's Division on Tax-Exempt Organizations, was placed last week on administrative leave with full pay of $177,000 a year after she took the Fifth Amendment before a congressional committee and refused a request that she resign. Almost everyone wants Lerner to be fired, from Republicans outraged that Tea Party groups got special scrutiny under her watch to President Obama, for whom she has become a political inconvenience. But it's very difficult to fire a federal employee, especially for mere incompetence. Only 0.55% of federal workers were fired in 2011, just one-fifth of the separation rate of the private sector. Why, in the culture of lowered expectations synonymous with government bureaucracy, the jobs of federal workers are protected by a thicket of rules. To be fired, they generally have to be caught in egregious misconduct, and proving a firing offense can take 18 months of tortured proceedings. Often, in cases like Lerner's, the government simply gives up or transfers the unwanted employee to another safe job. Nice work if you can get it. And the next column is entitled The GOP's Slavery Insult, written by Charles Blow in the New York Times. Why do Republicans keep on comparing blacks who support the Democratic candidates to slaves? Asked Charles Blow in the GOP's Democratic Plantation Trope. Blacks vote for Democrats only because Democrats take money from white people and give it to black people in the form of goodies like welfare and food stamps. It's the highest level of insult, implying that unlike other voters, African Americans are too stupid and lazy to make informed decisions about politics. To serve as safe mouthpieces for this slur, Republicans keep looking for black conservatives with a bomb-throwing rhetorical bent. The most recent example is E.W. Jackson, an extremist nut whom the GOP nominated to run for lieutenant governor of Virginia. Jackson has attacked gays as very sick, said liberalism has been far more lethal to black lives than the Ku Klux Klan, and dredged up the Democratic plantation analogy, saying we're going to the slave market voluntarily today. When Republicans nominate black candidates of this type, who is their intended audience? It's certainly not the 95% of black voters they think of as shiftless slaves. And now we'll flip to the back of the week magazine for our reading of The Last Word. And this sounds like it's going to be a relaxing story today. I hope so. It's entitled The Zen of Floating. After just 20 minutes in a sensory deprivation tank, said Seth Stevenson, you can reach a state of zero thought. How did I end up naked in a stranger's apartment, floating in a saltwater tub, surrounded by darkness and silence, realizing that for the first time in my life, I had achieved total mindfulness? Well, let's begin our story in 1961, when Peter Sudfeld was a first-year psychology graduate student at Princeton. Another scholar in the department was running a sensory deprivation study that offered $20 to volunteer subjects. Sudfeld wanted the cash, so he agreed to be shut inside a pitch-black, soundproofed room for 24 hours with only a bit of sustenance and a toilet to keep him company. He couldn't handle it. I was nervous and I got itchy and jumpy, he says now, so he left early. He wasn't the only one. Many subjects panicked, and some even reported that they'd had hallucinations. Though, or perhaps because, he'd gotten spooked, Sudfeld became intrigued by isolation chambers. Sensory deprivation was a sexy field of study in the 50s and 60s, and Sudfeld began to organize chamber experiments of his own. Soon enough, he became aware of another isolation technique. A man named John Lilly, first at the Naval Institute, later at the National Institute of Mental Health, had pioneered the use of an immersion water tank. In early trials, the subject was completely submerged wearing a breathing mask with an air hose connected to a pump. In a later iteration, the subject simply floated in salt water on his back in a coffin-like tank that was completely dark and silent. Lilly became a cultish Timothy Leary-like figure as his experiments grew more outlandish. He made attempts to communicate with animals and became famously fond of entering his flotation tanks only after he'd dosed himself with powerful hallucinogens, dramatized in the film Altered States. Sudfeld met Lilly and was impressed with his tanks, but not his methods. He started out as a straight scientist, says Sudfeld, but he got into taking drugs and thought he'd make contact with some sphere of consciousness beyond the normal. Thought he'd had conversations with Shakespeare and such. He didn't see eye to eye on how the tanks should be used. I always ran standard experiments with control groups and data and objective tests. Until I read a trend story about floating in the Wall Street Journal this February, I never realized it was possible to float in a non-scientific setting. Nor had it occurred to me that anyone would want to. I was suddenly intrigued. What could sensory deprivation do for me? One morning I went to a spa that has a tank, took off all my clothes, and after showering, stepped into a large tub inside an enclosed chamber. I slid the blackout door closed behind me, eased down into the water, and touched a button that switched off the lights. I was floating in total darkness and silence. The saturation of Epsom salts in the water made me unnaturally buoyant. My face, stomach, and knees, an archipelago of islands amid the tub's ocean. For the first 15 minutes, I wondered what I was doing there. I thought about my plans for that evening, stories I was working on, whether there was any food in the fridge back at the apartment. I felt bored. I felt silly. Like Peter Sudfeld in that chamber in Princeton, I even got jumpy. Then a transformation began. If you've ever taken psychedelic mushrooms, you might recall a certain feeling that arises as the drugs take hold. Something is happening, your body says to your brain with mild urgency. I got a feeling akin to that while floating. My brain went a little haywire. When the storm passed, I found myself in a new and unfamiliar state of mind. Sudfeld's studies have shown that tank sessions can be used to treat autonomic nervous system problems like chronic pain, high blood pressure, and motion disorders. They can improve perceptual and motor skills in athletes and creativity in artists. Sudfeld also claims that the tank shifts our brain's focus from its dominant to its non-dominant hemisphere, which has various benefits. But God only knows why hemisphere balance is affected, says Sudfeld. We can't yet fit a brain scanner in a tank or get the scanner wet, for that matter. For a tank newbie like me, the more intriguing aspects of floating include its possibly imagined Lilly-esque potential to reveal hidden layers of consciousness within, and its proven capacity to chill people out. Sudfeld happily acknowledges point two, anything related to psychological stress, he says, whether it's chronic tension headaches, insomnia, things with no known physical cause. After several floats, they really seem to improve. It's the meditative, relaxing qualities of floating that eventually moved the practice beyond academia into retail. Glenn Perry is perhaps the forefather of recreational tank use. Perry was a computer programmer in 1972 when he read Lilly's book, The Center of the Cyclone. The first time I floated, says Perry, I got out and I found that time had changed my senses and they were totally different. I instantly knew I had to build my own tank. By the end of the week, I decided to build tanks not just for myself, but for other people. After trying out several models, Perry settled on a tank that used 10-inch deep water saturated with Epsom salts. He and his wife Lee opened a float center in Beverly Hills in 1979, renting out their five tanks largely to entertainment industry types. Michael Crichton came in to float when he had a writer's block. Eventually, Crichton bought a tank of his own. Between the Perry's Float Center, Lilly's 1977 book The Deep South, and the 1980 release of Altered States, flotation entered the popular consciousness. A 1981 New York Times story noted that the industry was raking in $4 million a year on sales and rentals. It reported that new float centers were opening across the country. In the mid-1980s, the AIDS scare changed everything. People were frightened of contracting HIV from infected water and float tank centers. The business dried up, new agers switched to yoga, even the academic work fell out of favor. Radical students began to equate isolation studies with torture and brainwashing, says Sudfeld. People got hassled out of the field. By the time John Lilly died in 2001, it seemed that floating was over and done. Turns out it was unsinkable. The journal article that caught my eye notes a new wave of tank enthusiasm, crediting comedian Joe Rogan and stressed-out, chillaxation-hungry Bay Area techies for spreading the word. Further evidence of floating's resurgence, a float center in Portland, Oregon, has inaugurated an annual float conference. And now I'm part of the movement. Once I settled into my first tank session, I understood why all these people get jazzed about floating. For the first time in my waking life, I had zero thoughts. It was a mental quietude I'd never known existed. We had a Zen master who visited my lab once, says Sudfeld, and he asked to go in the tank for an hour. Most of his life he had meditated every day for 4 or 5 hours or more, and he thought the depth of meditation he reached in the tank was on par with a level he reached maybe once a year in his normal meditation environment, which was not exactly the middle of Times Square. He was amazed. The water and air in the float chamber are skin temperature. The darkness is identical with eyes opened or closed, and there is no sound, thus there is no external input. In turn, my brain decelerated until its output was also slowed and then stopped. I was suspended in a place with no space or time or purpose. Once in a while, some quotidian thought would begin to surface at the edges. Did I respond to that email? And then bounce around in the lonely void of my skull for a moment or two, but it would soon melt away as my brain realized it didn't care. Back to the void. When my one-hour session ended, I emerged in a profound daze. I spoke slowly and quietly, like a smooth jazz DJ. I felt more rested than if I'd slept for 16 hours on a pile of tranquilized chinchillas. Outside, colors were saturated, sounds were vivid. For my second session, I went to a loft apartment belonging to a tank owner, but the setup was not nearly as weird as you might imagine. He cordons off a private area in which you float, shower, and change. Having floated before, my transition happened more quickly this time. It took just a few minutes before I felt my brain and my body slowing, my restless thoughts fading out. If I chose to, I could purposefully focus on one idea at a time, roll it around in isolation, examine some part of my life with no distractions. Or I could just revel in the strangely exhilarating emptiness. At one point, I nodded off in the tank. The only way I knew this was that my limbs lightly spasmed, making a small splash. In that way, limbs do when you're at the edge of sleep. There was no clear line between consciousness and unconsciousness. I had no fear of drowning, as my buoyancy was such that it would nearly be impossible to roll over accidentally. Afterward, as the owner handed me a cup of herbal tea, he recounted his own conversion story. My first time was supposed to be a one-hour session, he told me, but the guy forgot about me and left me in the tank for several hours. I had a life-altering experience. I can't describe it to you now in a way that wouldn't devalue its meaning. Floating is the closest you will ever come to having a drug-like experience without taking drugs, though you will have no crazy hallucinations. At least I didn't have any. Your hallucinatory mileage may vary. You will understand your brain in an entirely new way. Consider, right now there are dozens of thoughts pinballing through your mind. When's lunch? This monitor is too bright. Should I ask her on a second date? My crotch itches. What is the person in the next cubicle saying on the phone? I should be more assertive. I'll get a burrito at lunch. Am I a good person? These thoughts are all occurring more or less simultaneously. There is a cacophony, a noisy din in your head. The absence of the din is a genuine revelation. Peter Sudfeld is now consulting with NASA and the Canadian Space Agency regarding the effects of long-duration spaceflight in confined, monotonous environments. Glenn Perry still sells tanks and says sales are on the rise. The annual Float Conference is running again this August. The motto is looking forward to a whole lot more nothing. As for me, I plan to climb back in a tank at least 3 or 4 times a year. Just thinking about the feeling I get from floating makes me crave it. I'm not sure I can fully explain why, but I'd love to ponder that question while buoyed by a tub full of warm, sultry water. And that was by Seth Stevenson, copyrighted 2013 by Slate.com. Now, from The Last Word, we will head over to the Health and Science Department in the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled, A Malfunction Halts the Exoplanet Hunt. The planet-hunting Kepler telescope, one of the most successful NASA missions of all time, may be down for the count. Two of the gyroscope-like wheels that keep the space telescope pointed at its targets have malfunctioned, and if one of them can't be restored, the science we were doing with Kepler as we were doing it is over, Kepler engineer John Trolsich tells Nature.com. Since its launch in 2009, Kepler has been surveying stars for variations in their light caused by orbiting planets, identifying 132 planets with a high degree of certainty and 2,740 possible planets. The science returns of the Kepler mission have been staggering and have changed our view of the universe, in that we now think there are planets just about everywhere, says Stanford University astronomer Scott Hubbard. Of the planets Kepler has identified, about 230 are roughly the size of the Earth. Just last month, data from the telescope revealed two planets only slightly larger than ours, 1,200 light-years away, orbiting in the habitable zone around their star, where temperatures could support liquid water and potentially life. Scientists will know in several months whether Kepler is salvageable. But even if it's not, says Hubbard, it has already shown the need for another orbiting telescope to search for Earth-like exoplanets. Our next article is entitled, Earth's Oldest Water. At the bottom of a gold mine, 1.5 miles deep, Canadian researchers have discovered a cache of ancient water that has been sealed off from the rest of the world for as long as 2.6 billion years. The water originated in a prehistoric sea at a time when the earliest single-celled organisms were evolving. The Toronto Globe and Mail reports, and its existence raises hopes that similar stores of water could exist deep below the surface of Mars. The sample contains substantial amounts of hydrogen, which might have served as a chemical fuel that could have allowed bacteria to survive for several billion years without sunlight or oxygen. If researchers can identify traces of microbes in the sample, they could learn more about how life evolved on Earth and where to look for it on Mars, says Greg Holland, a geochemist at Manchester University in the UK. When Mars was much more habitable 3 or 4 billion years ago, he says, maybe life there went underground and has carried on living happily ever since. And speaking of water, that leads us to the health scare of the week, which is don't swallow the pool water. Sounds like good advice. Swimmers beware. A new study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that 58% of community pools contain E. coli, a bacterium present in feces that can cause serious gastrointestinal problems. Most of the germs apparently come from fecal matter present on people's bodies. Michelle Hlavassa, chief of the CDC's Health Swimming Program, tells NBCNews.com, the average person has about 0.14 grams of feces on their rear end, Hlavassa said. Of the 161 pools in Atlanta that CDC researchers tested, one also contained Cryptosporidium, an organism that causes diarrhea, and two had Giardia, I believe it's pronounced, a parasite that can cause stomach pains and nausea. Remember, chlorine and other disinfectants don't kill germs instantly, Hlavassa said. To reduce the risk of infection with fecal bacteria, experts recommend that you rinse off with soap before and after diving in and avoid swallowing any water. And it takes the thrill out of going to the pool, doesn't it? Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled, Bridge Collapses, More to Come. Every day we drive on bridges, overpasses, and viaducts that we assume must be safe, said David K. Johnston in the DailyBeast.com. Last week we were reminded twice that our trust is badly misplaced. In Skagit, Washington, a 160-foot section of the four-lane steel truss bridge of Interstate 5 collapsed after a truck bumped into its aging trusses, causing several vehicles to plunge 25 feet into the ice-cold waters below. Miraculously, no one was killed. Just days after that, a Missouri highway overpass collapsed when two trains collided, injuring seven. Put simply, our nation's aging infrastructure is crumbling. Every day, 200 million Americans cross bridges that have exceeded their design life or have been found structurally deficient. Overall, the American Society of Civil Engineers has given the nation's highway bridges a grade of C+. As the Skagit Bridge collapse showed, an obsolete bridge can fail without warning. It's just a matter of time before we have many more such disasters. It may take a lot of disasters to change Congress's mind, said Abby Phillip in ABCNews.com. The Federal Highway Administration says we'd have to spend about $90 billion in additional funds every year to bring roads and bridges up to safety standards. But congressional Republicans aren't in a spending mood. They recently rejected President Obama's request for a modest $50 billion to rebuild roads and bridges, dismissing it as an unfunded wish list. Historically, states and local governments have paid for most infrastructure repairs, said Brad Plummer in WashingtonPost.com. But since the economic downturn in 2008, they have pulled way back on spending. California, for example, cut transportation spending by 31% between 2007 and 2009. Despite these budget pressures, said Derek Thompson in TheAtlantic.com, simply ignoring the problem is very short-sighted. America's 607,380 bridges have an average age of 42 years, and the need to repair or replace them isn't going away. Right now, the government can borrow money at bargain basement interest rates of about 1%, the lowest in our nation's history. So here's our choice, said Johnston in the DailyBeast.com. We can fund a major reconstruction program and in the process put tens of thousands of the still unemployed back to work, or we can wait for more collapses. Why put off until tomorrow what is cheaper to do today? And now, from the Week magazine, we'll turn to a few shorter items here as we reach the end of the program this week. First one is this. Australia has been ranked as the happiest industrialized nation on Earth for the third straight year. Sweden came in second, Canada third, and the U.S. sixth in quality of life rankings, which are judged on employment, income, environment, and health. Although the U.S. is overall the richest nation in the world, 24% of Americans say they have had trouble putting food on the table in the past 12 months, up from 16% in 2007, before the Great Recession began. In Australia, Canada, and Germany, only 10% said they had trouble getting food last year. Federal scientists predict an above-normal Atlantic hurricane season with 7 to 11 hurricanes and 3 to 6 major hurricanes this year. That's nearly double the normal hurricane activity. The drought that reduced the flow of the Colorado River last year has worsened, with its reservoirs, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, headed toward 45% capacity, the lowest level since 1968. The Colorado provides water to 40 million people in the Southwest and in California. Up to 60% of tickets for concerts and theater events are being snapped up by computer programs or bots, many of them run out of India and Russia. The tickets are then resold online at sizable premiums. And now the poll watch for this week. 35% of Americans self-identify as conservative on social issues, while 32% call themselves moderate. 30% say they're liberal, a new high in that category. And 54% of Americans say they're opposed to Obamacare, 35% believe it is too liberal, while 16% say it doesn't go far enough and they would prefer to see more government control of health care. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.